James is addressing in James chapter 3 our speech and how we speak, and particularly in the context of how as a church we are speaking to one another. As we go through the rest of this book, we'll see more of James addressing how they are speaking. We've seen it alluded to in chapter 2 as he's talking about the treatment of the rich man and the poor man within the church. But we're going to see it come out a little bit more particularly in chapter 4. But he's addressing the way that we converse with one another. And so in James chapter 3, verse 1, he says, "My brethren, be not many masters, knowing that we shall receive the greater condemnation. For in many things we offend all. If any man offend not in word, the same is a perfect man, and able also to bridle the whole body. Behold, we put bits in the horses' mouths, that they may obey us, and we turn about their whole body. Behold also the ships, which though they be so great, and are driven of fierce winds, yet they are turned about with a very small helm, whithersoever the God listeth. Even so the tongue is a little member, and boasteth great things. Behold how great a matter a little fire kindleth. And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. So is the tongue among our members, that it defileth the whole body, and setteth on fire the course of nature, and it is set on fire of hell. For every kind of beast, and of birds, and of serpents, and of things in the sea is tamed, and hath been tamed of mankind. But the tongue can no man tame. It is an unruly evil, full of deadly poison. Therewith bless we God, even the Father, and therewith curse we men, which are made after the similitude of God. Out of the same mouth proceedeth blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not so to be. Doth the fountain send forth at the same place sweet water and bitter? Can the fig tree, my brethren, bear olive berries? Either a vine fig? So can no fountain yield both salt water and fresh." Living in the Upper Peninsula, we are really fortunate to have relatively very little dangerous wildlife. One need not be afraid of poisonous snakes or too concerned about deadly spiders. I can see my kids outside chasing a snake and I don't have to worry about whether or not it's a copperhead or a water moccasin. Pretty good odds it's a garter snake or maybe a pine snake, and nothing too serious. And we have wolves and bears in the woods, but they are still somewhat scarce, and they're more likely to run away than to threaten you, at least at this point. But everyone would be rightly concerned if there was a wolf prowling around in your backyard, and it was just always there hanging around. Most would not feel very comfortable with a large bear hanging out around your house all the time. And we are wise to take precautions with dangerous animals. And so even though there's, you know, relatively few around us, we still are very wise to be aware of them and to take precautions regarding them. Even professional animal trainers, they take great care around the creatures that they work with. As we know that a wild animal is still that. It's a wild animal. They can be unpredictable and they can be deadly. And yet, even though we would never think of letting a wild wolf run loose in our house, we harbor something that is even more dangerous, and we often exercise minimal care to keep it under control. And much of the book of James deals with the proper expression of our faith through our speech and conversation with one another. This is a major theme in this book. In verse 19 of chapter 1, he says, "Let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath." In chapter 2, in verse 12, he says, "So speak ye, and so do ye, as they that shall be judged by the law of liberty." In chapter 4, verse 11, he says, "Simply speak not evil of one another, brethren." And in contrast with the evil speech that James warns us against, he says in chapter 5, verse 16, "Confess your faults one to another and pray one for another." I think one can reasonably argue that James chapter 2 all the way through James chapter 5 has in their entirety the tongue as the focus. The believer's speech is a major part of the book of James. And the passage before us is really the central passage dealing with that. It should be one of the most familiar passages regarding the tongue. It is certainly one of the most significant passages in the Bible about the dangers of the tongue. And in these 12 verses, James gives some very necessary warnings for the believer to set a close guard on his tongue. And it begins with the first verse. And at first glance, it may seem kind of arbitrary and thrown in there, but he's setting the platform for the rest of what's to come. He's really verses 2 to 12 are the reason, part of the reasons why verses 2 to 12 is part of the explanation of what he says in verse 1. In verse 1, he says, "Don't be many masters. Do not desire to be teachers." That's that word master. Hebrew, we use the word rabbi. Greek, it is didaskalos. It is used speaking of the apostles. It's used speaking of Christ. It is used speaking of the responsibility of pastors. It is used throughout scriptures as something that is necessary. And in fact, Hebrews chapter 5, the author of Hebrews rebukes the believers because they should be teachers and they're not. And so once again, we have a statement from James that maybe at first glance says, what's he saying? How does this line up with all the rest of, you know, the way that being a teacher is used positively? But what James is saying is don't be longing for this responsibility of teaching. I mean, let me just be very blunt. It's not a position to be desired. And I'll be real open and honest with you here. I hear young men that say, you know, I think God's calling me to be a pastor. And my first response, and don't take this wrongly, but often the first thing pops in my head is, don't do it. And one of the reasons is a reason that James gives. And this is not, I do not want to trivialize this at all. And so as we talk about this, I don't want to just, okay, he's just kind of, you know, exaggerating here. He's making a big deal out of nothing. This is a major thing that James is addressing. And he is saying, don't be seeking for this position, for this responsibility. Now, let me say, before I address what he's saying here, it's not something to be avoided. And say, oh, pastor said I shouldn't be a teacher, therefore, nope, I'm not going to teach. I'm not trying to give you an out. It is not something to be avoided. If those who are gifted to teach, you must teach. Period. You don't have an option. If you've been gifted to teach, you must be exercising that gift within the context of the local church. If you're not, you are not doing what you are supposed to as a Christian. You are not applying the gifts as you ought to be applying them. It is not something to be avoided, but with the position comes the accountability. Because then that's exactly what James is saying. He says, don't desire this position of teaching because with that comes greater judgment. This is one of the reasons the whole idea of standing up in front of a congregation and teaching the Word of God is terrifying. Because there is an accountability before God for what is taught and for who is taught, who are taught. The judgment coming for a teacher is much, much greater. It's interesting as I've talked to people that, and we talk about, you know, public teaching or public speaking kind of ministries. Most of the people that say, well, you know, I really don't want to do that, they're fearful of it, but they're fearful for the wrong reasons. They're fearful of the prospect of standing in front of a group of people and maybe forgetting what they're supposed to say or making a mistake or maybe being stumped by a difficult question. They're afraid they might be tongue-tied. God does not hold teachers accountable for stuttering, or for being tongue-tied, or for getting their words twisted up. In fact, everyone that has done any kind of significant teaching and preaching can tell a number of embarrassing stories about the things they have accidentally said. It comes with the territory. But that's not why we should be afraid. The real reason to be troubled at the thought of teaching is the accountability for the influence that is being wielded. The teacher is not going to be held accountable for not matching the audience's expectations of entertainment value. Every teacher is going to be held accountable by God for how he has used his influence and his position. Every teacher is going to be held accountable to God for what he has said as he has been teaching. And so James is saying here, brethren, don't be longing for this. This is not a position to covet. It's not, and it certainly is not something I want to covet that influence. And this is where sometimes we fall afoul of this verse is, well, I don't want to teach a Sunday school class, but I do want to be able to exercise that level of influence over individuals in the congregation. We don't want the responsibility of standing up in public and teaching, but we do want the benefits of having some influence and ability to sway opinions within the congregation. That is that idea of being a master. Whether you have the official title or not, the desire or the wielding of influence within and over a congregation is that which you will be held accountable for. And so it's not just saying don't desire or do not be many teachers. He's saying don't be many leaders. Don't go seeking after this thing merely for the sake of the power that you think you will get to wield. Because you are going to be held accountable. Hebrews 13:17. It tells the congregation to submit themselves to those that have the rule over you, and it warns them to do so because they give account for your souls. They give account for your souls. So what that means, let me put it in a context other than me, is right now, Ruth and Jean and Dave give account and will give account for the teenagers and kids that are under their teaching ministry. They will give account. Right now, Dave and Chuck will give account for how they are using the influence they have as deacons within the congregation. That's what's really being talked about here. And we should not be hungering for this power, such as it is, hungering for this influence or this notoriety, because it is something that we will stand before God and give an account of. And so he says, he keeps going here, verse 2, for in many things we offend all. If any man offend not in word, the same as a mature man, and able also to bridle the whole body. Really, the primary means by which we instruct and influence others is through our tongue. This is obviously it is our means of communication. And it is still and will always be primary means of communication. And James is saying to these that would maybe think they really want that position, that this matter of the tongue, which in that responsibility of being a teacher, you're going to use a lot. This little thing of the tongue is an unruly, hard to control thing. It is a small member, and it does big things. The reason the teachers and leaders should be concerned about the coming judgment is that our tongue is an unruly beast. If one can consistently control his speech and direct it for godly purposes, he is a mature Christian. And in this section of James, the apostle does not identify maturity based on the length of time saved or based on the ability to explain difficult doctrine or the knowledge of doctrine or even the size of the audience that may be listening to him. Maturity is identified as a matter of being able to control the tongue. This little member is a big troublemaker, and the one who can control it can control every part of his being. And to illustrate this point, James uses three very common objects as analogies: a bridle, a rudder, and a flame. And the significance of each illustration is identical. A little thing moves great things. So a large, high-spirited, powerful stallion can easily be turned about and directed by a small, dainty lady. There's no amount of her strength that could come up to that horse and could push it around and drag it against its will. But you put a small metal rod in the horse's mouth, tie some straps at each end of that rod, and that horse can be readily controlled by anyone. 1,000 pounds of muscle and flesh is controlled by a few ounces of metal. On the sea, there are many, many great vessels. And today we have behemoths that are hundreds of feet long, driven by multiple engines with thousands of horsepower. And these great ships travel across our ocean carrying thousands of tons of materials and goods, and yet one man can direct the entire ship wherever he likes with the push of a lever or the turn of a wheel. Because in the back of every ship is a rudder or a pair of rudders. So the largest ship in the world can be turned by a comparatively small sheet of wood or metal. It's a little thing that turns great things. If you remember Smokey the Bear, you'll know the next illustration very well. He's warned us often of the great danger of just a little fire, a careless cigarette, a lit match, or a forgotten campfire coal can set thousands of acres ablaze. So is the tongue. It is a comparatively small organ, makes up only a tiny part of our entire person. But the matters with which the tongue directs are massive matters. They are things of the utmost importance. Proverbs 18:21 warns us, death and life are in the power of the tongue. This little organ has the ability to cause more trouble or bring more blessing than anything known to mankind. The most dangerous and destructive weapon in the world today is not a massive nuclear warhead that is able to demolish an entire city. The most dangerous and destructive weapon in the world today is the unrestrained tongue. And do not mistake that for hyperbole. It's not some pastoral exaggeration to prove a point. I say that having seen firsthand the horrific destruction done by the tongue. I say that having seen souls refuse the gospel and flee to hell because of the unrestrained tongue. This little thing is a small member that affects the greatest of matters. And that by itself, that should be enough to make us stop and button our lips. But James isn't done yet. James gets deeper. Because some folks have the delusion that they have the ability to control their tongues. And some folks have the insane belief that their unrestrained mouth isn't doing any harm. And that is the height of insanity. This is ridiculous folly. And really, James says, in this passage, he says the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. Do you see that there in verse 6? A world of iniquity. He says at the end of the verse, it is set on fire of hell. Verse 8, he says, but the tongue can no man tame. It is an unruly evil, full of deadly poison. Does that sound like something you can get a handle on? That sounds like something, you know, with proper use of discipline and rewards that you can control it and you can bring it into line. James is saying this tongue is out of control. The tongue is highly destructive. A little spark can burn down Yellowstone, but that doesn't compare to the destructive power of the tongue. Every imaginable sin is possible for the tongue. That's why he says it's a world of iniquity. Every imaginable sin is possible for the tongue. All of it. So things people would never actually do, they will speak of. So the tongue will pollute the whole person. It defiles the whole body. It defames all of nature. It embraces every kind of sin imaginable. It is a destructive force, defiling everything it touches. And it is diabolical. It is set on fire of hell. It is unruly. It is devilish. It is demonic. It is a fire that has been lit by the spark of hell itself. It is uncontrollable, and its wickedness comes straight from the pit. And to draw the contrast, he says in verse 7, every kind of beast and of birds and of serpents and of things in the sea is tamed and has been tamed of mankind. Man has been able to capture and control just about every imaginable kind of animal. When you think about it, we have people that make a living jumping on the back of crocodiles, wrestling with pythons, taming elephants, boxing with bears, training tigers. You pick the animal, I think you can find somebody that has managed to tame it and to use it for his own purposes. Every kind of animal has been tamed and is tameable, but the devilish strip of muscle behind your teeth is beyond control. It is unruly, it is disobedient, it's always demanding to break free and to wreak havoc on its unsuspecting victims. What James says is that this trivial little organ is a diabolic fiend just waiting to break free, to rampage and destroy. It is unruly, full of deadly poison. What hope is there? I mean, so far, about the only useful application from what has been said is just stop talking. Take a vow of silence. Don't say anything ever again. Of course, we know from scriptures, we are commanded to speak. So silence is not an option. We are messengers. We are witnesses. We are called and commanded to use our mouths to minister grace to those who hear us. The tongue cannot be tamed, but we cannot fall back onto a hope of saying more good than a bad, of dividing our time between blessing and cursing. James is saying, part of what James says there in verses 9 and 10. We can't divide our time. We can't take our tongue and use it viciously here and then think it's all right because we used it graciously there. I can't curse my fellow believer and turn around and sing praise to God. I cannot gripe and complain. I cannot murmur and dispute. I cannot engage in strife and division and then turn around and say all kinds of wonderful things of worship. He says this is not to be. We can't divide our tongues. We can't speak with forked tongues, saying one thing here and another thing there. We can't be double-minded, as he says in chapter 1. Here we can't be double-tongued. We must speak truth and love. We must bless God. We must bless our fellow believer. We must encourage. We must exhort. We must admonish. We must control our tongue, but James has declared it is patently impossible. What do we do? Well, he points to the answer in verses 11 and 12. But particularly, let me show you verse 12. It says, So can no fountain both yield salt water and fresh. Our mouth has a source. What comes out of our mouth is not sourced in our tongue. It is sourced elsewhere. And he points to that in verse 14. He tells us the problem. But if you have bitter envying and strife in your hearts, there's the problem. Chapter 4, he says the same thing, identifying the desires of their heart as the source of their conflicts. And James gives the solution in verses 6 to 10 of chapter 4. The solution is humility, submission before God, resisting the devil, drawing close to God, cleansing your deeds and your heart. And we're going to be looking at those passages in the weeks ahead, so I'm not going to address them today. What I want to do instead is go back and address the foundational point, the source, the heart. Because that is what the issue really is. What is in the heart? Some of you may remember last year I preached a series of messages on idols of the heart. One of the principles from that series, and I've tried to communicate it clearly and regularly since then, is that our heart controls our behavior. So what we do is because of what is within our hearts. And as a result, our behavior reveals our heart. So how we act shows what's truly in our heart. So what we have learned in that series and other places in scriptures is what is in your heart will absolutely control how you behave. So how you behave gives a really good indication of what's really in your heart, and this is particularly so of your speech. How you speak reveals what's in your heart. As Jesus said in Matthew 12:34, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. It is out of the heart that is the mouth speaks. Since that is true, the only way the tongue is tamed is for the heart to be transformed. That's it. Because really, the issue, and this is the overriding issue in all of the book of James, the issue is not what's on the tip of your tongue. The issue is what is in your heart. What is going on within you? And as we think of this whole matter of maturing, to come to a point where I'm speaking biblical truth, I'm speaking edifying words, I'm ministering grace to the hearers, and all the process between, it does not come about merely because I've said, okay, he said I've got to attend, so I'm going to be faithful in going to church. Yes, you should be faithful in church, in attending church. But that flows out of an issue that's even deeper than your whether or not you show up at 10:30 on Sunday or 9:30 on Sunday morning for Sunday school. And whether or not you show up for church, it is an issue that gets down into the heart. And I can say just on that one point and in all of them, your attendance or lack of attendance, your commitment to attending church reveals something about your heart. Without fail, it reveals something about your heart. And in the same fashion, what you speak, what your conversation is like, what you say when you say what you really want to say, what you find your habit, your conversation centering on, that reveals something about your heart. And the way to change your church attendance or your service in the church or any of these other things, the way to attempt to change your speech is for the heart to be transformed. This is what James is driving at, and I'm getting a little bit ahead of the text in James here, but I want us to have this clearly in our minds. The issue is our heart. So first there has to be salvation. If Christ has not made you a new creature, then your mouth is inevitably going to vomit out its wickedness. I mean, read Titus chapter 3. First couple verses there, it tells us what is in our heart. And that is going to come out of your mouth. And there must be salvation to transform that vile heart into that which can be pleasing to God, that which is righteous and holy before Him. Christians, you must be continually being renewed. so that the heart that is within you is a heart that is right with God. And so, really, the way to control the tongue is not to focus on the words you are saying or the content of your conversations. Now, there's some balance on that. Don't say I disregard it completely. But it's not to give your focus and say, well, I'm going to just stop saying these things or stop talking about these things, or I'm just going to, you know, put a quarter in the jar every time I say certain things. That's all external. The way to control the tongue is to fill your heart with the godly things that you know you ought to be talking about. It is to put in your heart and in your mind those things that should be coming out of your mouth. So thus, if you are to speak grace to one another, then you need to pour into your heart the truths of the grace of God. If you are to speak the truth in love, then you need to fill your heart with truth. You need to fill your heart with the glories of the love of God. We can see this in Colossians chapter 3. In that chapter, we're commanded to put off blasphemy, filthy communication, and lying, among other things. In that chapter, we are told the mind is renewed by the knowledge of Christ, and the old deeds are replaced with righteous deeds. The old speech is replaced with righteous speech. And this is accomplished by giving God's peace the rule of your hearts. Let God, through His Holy Spirit, rule your heart. And coupled with that is a letting of the Word of God abundantly prosper in your life, so that then you will teach and admonish one another. The way to correct the heart, or excuse me, the way to correct your tongue is to fill your heart with the things of God. That's the issue. That is the whole point James is making. So when he says, don't desire to be a teacher and a leader, don't be seeking these positions of a presumed power and importance. Because your tongue is an unruly evil thing. He is moving towards chapter 4 and saying, because your heart is filled with selfishness and self-seeking. Your heart is filled with these lusts of the things of the world. It is not consumed with and humbled before God. The issue is the heart. And if your speech is not right, you can be absolutely certain it is clear indication that your heart is not right. If you do not speak as you ought, particularly if you consistently do not speak as you ought, it is clear indication that your heart is not as it ought to be. If you find yourself bored with the things of God, that points to a heart problem. If you have no ability to talk about spiritual things, it is because you are not putting godly things into your heart. If you just don't want to talk about the things of God, you have a heart that doesn't really care about godly things. So that if you want to gossip and grumble and that drives your conversations, then you have a heart that loves gossip and is discontented. Your speech is revealing your heart. Your speech is controlled by your heart. So what James is driving us to, and what I want to call us to and point us to this morning, is that we need to be transformed in the heart. We need to be transformed within. Certainly your speech must be right. Certainly your tongue must be tamed. But you can't do it, especially if your heart is filled with sin. So focus your time and energy on what's in your heart. Go to chapter 4 of James. Let me just read you very quickly what he says here. Verse 4. Ye adulterers and adulteresses, know ye not that the friendship of the world is enmity with God? Whosoever therefore will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God. There's the problem. What are you wanting? Do you think that the scripture saith in vain, the spirit that dwelleth in us lusteth to envy? We have an uncontrolled evil spirit, that natural man, that old man that we are supposed to be putting off. But then he says, but he giveth more grace. So that even as Paul says, where great sin abounds, grace does much more abound. This is not a moment of despair, but it should be a moment of utter dependence and of rejoicing as we look to God who gives more grace. Verse 6, wherefore he saith, God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace unto the humble. Therefore, because of that, submit yourselves to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, ye sinners, and purify your hearts, ye double-minded. Be afflicted and mourn and weep. Because of your wicked hearts, because of your sin, because of your selfish desires that are ruling you, weep. Do not rejoice in them. Mourn over them. And then he says in verse 10, humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he shall lift you up. That's what we're talking about. It's coming before God in utter humility and brokenness, recognizing that in me dwelleth no good thing, but that he gives abundant grace to produce in me that which is pleasing to him, so that I can go out and I can speak that which is righteous. That I can stand up in front of a congregation knowing I'm going to give account and speak as I ought. That I can minister to a group of children knowing I'm going to give an account because I speak as I ought because of what he is doing. Knowing that I can converse with my fellow believers, knowing I'm going to give an account for every idle word. Because he gives more grace. Because he produces in me the changed heart that controls and rightly controls the tongue. So as we think of this passage this morning, your tongue is a vile thing. Your heart controls it. So let the Word of God, let God through His Spirit transform your heart. Pour into yourself the things of God that you will be transformed. Let your mind be continually renewed that you'll be transformed into the image of Christ, beginning within, and it will work its way out.